Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the show, a massive tax reform proposal by state lawmakers draws fire from teachers and poverty advocates. State and local leaders say they'll consider keeping the downtown homeless shelter open through the winter to address a long-predicted shortfall in beds. And poll monitors in San Juan County report irregularities in the early voting process, including potential electioneering. And joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune reporter Bethany Rogers. Good morning to you, Bethany.
Hi.
Also, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Taylor Stevens. Hi, Taylor, and good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Salt Lake Tribune columnist, said Salt Lake Tribune a few times here, Robert Gerke. Thanks for
being
here.
We're all from the Salt Lake Tribune. Let's keep the plugs coming. Hey,
okay.
Good morning.
And you can join us with any questions and comments that you have, listeners. The number to call is 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Or you can tweet to us. The handle is at KCPW. Let's begin today with tax reform. It's the most engaging topic out there right now.
All the kids are talking about it.
Bethany Rogers, last week a couple of plans were unveiled to tackle overhauling the state's tax system. And maybe before we get to the specifics of the proposals, what's driving tax reform in the state, or why is this happening now, if you can answer that question?
Yeah, so lawmakers have spent all summer trying to explain that to people or justify this whole exercise, and I'm not sure that it's really come across. So the argument is that the sales tax, which supports most of the general government programs and services out there, is sort of dwindling. It's still growing, but more slowly, they say, than the economy and more slowly than the growth of Utah's needs. Meanwhile, the income tax is just growing very quickly, but all of those revenues are dedicated constitutionally to public education. So lawmakers can't really use that money for other things or can't spread it around the way they want to. So basically what they're looking to do is, as they say, correct a revenue imbalance, create more flexibility in their budgeting so that they can pay for things like health services, public safety programs, just all of the things that fall under the umbrella of government outside of education.
And okay, so a disparity between income and sales tax, trying to solve that problem. Lawmakers have tried to do this before. In fact, just at this last legislative session, they tried and that didn't go anywhere. What are they proposing to do now? Is there a specific proposal being considered?
Yes. Well, so as you mentioned, there are several plans released over recent days by members of the Tax Reform Task Force. It's a group of legislators who have been spending recent months sort of touring the state, listening to residents, and trying to come up with plans. But the co-chairs of the task force unveiled their own plan, and that's been kind of viewed as the main one, the one that they're going to be working from. What that plan would do is it would increase the sales tax on food to the 4.5% rate from the lower rate at which food is now taxed. It would also expand the sales tax to cover gas purchases. So when you fill up your car, it would expand the sales tax also to some services like landscaping, Uber, streaming services. There's a big long list. And then on the other side, it would offer tax relief by cutting the income tax rate down and then also offering targeted relief to offset the food tax, because there is concern that that would disproportionately affect lower income folks. So there is a grocery store credit included in the package as sort of a recognition of that.
Okay. I want to get to that part in just a minute, but just going back to the services being taxed, some representatives from industries that would feel the effect of those taxes on certain services, they showed up at a public meeting this week to complain, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What did they say?
They said that they don't want to be taxed, essentially. So you saw everyone from veterinarians. The Utah Veterinarians Association came out and said, hey, we take care of cats and dogs and other pets, and that's part of also keeping humans healthy, preventing the spread of animal diseases. So So why are you taxing us and not human healthcare? You had people who own spas and car washes saying that taxing their businesses would also wipe out their profits in some cases, or at the very least affect them negatively. You had people from the rare coin industry coming out and saying, please don't tax, you know, gold, silver, and that kind of thing, because it would impact their business as well. So yeah, just like every sector you can think of that would be affected by this tax form, there's basically a lobbyist or an association that represents them, and they came out to speak against it.
That's part of what maybe derailed the tax reform efforts at the state legislature this past session, is how have members of this committee, or in the hearing even, how did they respond to these concerns from various industries?
So they didn't respond directly. They took feedback and then they just kind of moved forward with the plan. I think that their idea is to draft some legislation, come back at the next meeting on November 7th, and get into the nuts and bolts of what they really want to go into this legislation, into the bill. So they said, okay, we'll just move forward with the co-chair's proposal as a starting point. And then, you know, other members of the task force who had ideas, you guys can jump in November 7th and sort of help us continue to develop and refine this package.
And it's sort of the favored package, but there are other packages out there. Maybe hold off on that for just a second, because I want to ask about the food tax that is part of the sort of main proposal, the central proposal. And it's, again, the idea is to increase the sales tax on food from 1.75% to 4.85%. That was met with public resistance as well. And, you know, you talked about this this credit to help people with groceries. How did, you know, I know that there were poverty advocates in attendance at these meetings, advocates for those who are living in poverty. What did they have to say about the food tax?
So many of them said this will impact lower to middle income Utahns negatively. As a percent of income, people who are on the lower end of the income spectrum tend to spend more of their earnings on food, since it's an essential. I guess there's only so many groceries you can buy, even if you buy more expensive groceries. So, your lower income families tend to spend a larger percentage of their earnings and salaries on those purchases. And even with the credit, there's concern that it wouldn't actually get into the hands of Utahns, because it involves filling out an extra form to qualify. There's a concern that maybe people wouldn't be informed that they qualify for it. A lot of lower income folks don't file income taxes. So if they didn't, they would have to go and seek out the form from the Utah Tax Commission. So there would have to be this whole process of educating people and kind of a bureaucratic step before they could get the money.
A hurdle, basically.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
There's more from this plan that I want to talk about, including the earmark on education and so on. But just on this topic of the food tax, I want to bring in columnist Robert Gerke, news columnist Robert Gerke, who I know you addressed this in not just the food tax, but you addressed this entire plan in a column this week. How about that plan to increase the sales tax on food from from 1.75% to 4.85%?
I mean, in theory, it could work out, right? I mean, on paper, it looks like it could balance out and not hurt the low-income people. But in reality, it's kind of another story. The biggest issue that I have, frankly, is that if you're low-income, you live month to month. You live paycheck to paycheck. And if you start having those paychecks getting more and more consumed by paying a food tax, you're going to end up short, right? And then while it's nice that in come April you can file this tax return and get some money back, and, you know, if you were smart and have the means, you can put it in a bank account and use it a little bit every month, I just don't think that's very realistic. And we've seen it with the earned income tax credit, that only about three-fourths of the people who are eligible for it actually end up getting it. This is a tax credit that is similar to the credits they're talking about on the food tax side. And they don't get it because there's paperwork that goes into this. You know, you've got to file a tax return. You've got to know to claim it. And so it's money that's left on the table. And the state, frankly, hasn't done all that much to make it easier. So while from a practical, mathematical, number standpoint, it works. I think in a real life standpoint, it raises a lot of problems.
Okay. Bethany, now I want to turn to the question of the earmark for education. Utah's constitution says that all, as you pointed out, all income tax revenue is to be spent on public and higher education. Changing that is something that the education community, that educators in Utah are not a fan of. Can you talk about that part of this proposal?
Yeah. So the proposal, as you mentioned, it would do away with that earmark, and it would allow lawmakers to basically tap into the money from income taxes. Now, there is a process for that to happen. It would have to pass the legislature by 2/3, and then it would have to go on the ballot before Utah voters. So there is a lengthy road to get there. But what we heard from Heidi Matthews with the Utah Education Association earlier this week is that the plan that's now on the table would kind of hit education potentially in two ways. The income tax cut, as I mentioned, income taxes going to education, could potentially deprive, you know, schools and education of funding, of state funding, and then also allowing lawmakers to tap into income taxes for other purposes could potentially be another hit to education. On top of that, the package also contains a measure that would take funding for the school lunch program, and instead of taking it out of the general fund, move that into the education or into the income tax fund as well. So that's another shift that would sort of impact education. So on all of these fronts, Heidi Matthews, the education advocate there speaking, said that there's potential loss in the classroom when it comes to class sizes, when it comes to school safety, when it comes to programs, and she's very concerned about that.
What do lawmakers say about, especially the two co-chairs of this committee, what do they say about ensuring or guaranteeing that education funding, you know, remains at current levels or, you know, even perhaps grows with their proposal?
They say they're working on it.
Okay.
They don't have exactly a plan mapped out yet. They say that they're in negotiations with members of the education community, and they did not offer much detail or have not offered much detail on exactly what negotiations are happening or what's going on behind the scenes. They did open a bill file on Tuesday that will take a look at making sure education funding levels, there's funding in place for education and it remains at current levels or it remains stabilized. But beyond that, we don't know much.
Robert Kirky, on the question of the earmark.
This is the most frustrating part for me of this whole process that they're going through. The argument is they've got two buckets. They've got the fund that pays for everything, the social services, prisons, highway patrol troopers, all of that stuff. And then they've got the bucket that pays for schools. And they said there's not enough in the bucket that pays for everything else. So they want to get rid of this bucket system and put them together. And that gives them the flexibility they need to pay for all these things. Well, you can see who's going to lose out in that scenario. It's a matter of taking money out of education so you can pay for these other things. It's a fundamental mathematical reality. And then they want to do it with a tax cut added into it. So they're actually taking $75 million out of the buckets and thinking that they can spread it around to cover everything they need. And it's just not feasible. It's not realistic. And I've gone around and around with a couple different members of the task force, and they keep claiming they can do it, but it's just not. Math tells you you can't do that.
Would you advocate, I mean, as a columnist, would you advocate for the two, you know, buckets remaining separate, meaning the fact that there would still be the earmark for education, in perpetuity?
Yeah, I mean, the fact of the matter is that Utah schools are still last in the nation in per pupil funding. I think we've heard that a billion times. And, you know, they've made good progress. They spent about $1.3 billion over the last several years on education. And that's good, because they've been shortchanged for so long. The only assurance that education has that those funding levels will continue is this earmark in the Constitution. And the only reason to get rid of the earmark in the Constitution is that so lawmakers can spend less. They if they wanted to spend more on education, they've got that flexibility now. They can take sales tax money and spend it in schools. But that's not what they're wanting to do. They're wanting to take the money out of education. And as Bethany noted, they're already starting to move in that direction where they want to take this liquor tax money, $45 to $50 million a year that goes to fund school lunches. They want to take that out of the school lunch program and let the schools figure that out themselves. Let them spread the money around that they're getting now, but that means there's less money going into these public schools than they otherwise would be getting, and so it's a bad deal for schools. And the only protection that schools have had over the years is that constitutional earmark. Mm-hmm. Now legislators argue, well, we always take money out of the education fund, and they do. If they give income tax credits or rebates to different groups, exemptions, if they lower the tax rate, that's money that comes out of education. And so their point is, if we want to take money out of education, we can do that without getting rid of the earmark. But this just makes it that much easier. It makes it a lot less transparent when they do it. And at the end of the day, they don't solve the problem that they set out to solve in the first place. If they're cutting taxes by $75 million, they're not addressing this issue of not having enough money for, you know, health care or, you know, roads. That's a big one that they're worried about, is, you know, not enough money to maintain the roads. They're not addressing all of these other issues that they said they're going to address in the first place. And the reason for that is the only way you can do that is if you bring in more tax revenue. You can't shrink the tax revenue and pay for more stuff. You've got to grow the tax revenue. And they're afraid to do that. And they're afraid to take on the big, powerful interest, special interest on Capitol Hill.
What about just accounting for the disparity between income and sales tax, you know, in general? Is that something that the state needs to do, Robert Kirky? I mean, could you conceivably leave things the way they are?
Well, if you wanted to do that, the argument you would have to make is that we're spending enough on education, they've got their share, and we're going to, you know, curtail the growth in the education fund. And if they wanted to make that argument, that's an honest, legitimate debate to have. And that's the argument they should be making, but they're afraid to say that. It's politically infeasible for them to say that we've given enough to education when we're still last in the nation. The other thing that you mentioned, though, about the difference between the sales tax and the income tax is, if you look at who pays which, low-income people pay the largest percentage of their income on a sales tax because they're buying things that they have to buy, but they're not making a lot of money, so they don't pay a lot on income tax. The highest earners in the state are the ones who pay the most of their income into income tax. And so if you cut the income tax and you raise the sales tax, it doesn't take a genius to figure out who's getting a better deal out of this.
Bethany Rogers, this package would result in an overall tax cut of roughly $79 million. What is the next step in this process? I mean, a lot of sound and fury so far. Where does this process go next? You said a bill file has been opened. Is that the next step?
Yep. They're working to draft legislation right now. The next task force meeting is on November 7th, and then there's one later in November that we're expecting to be the last one. As things stand, it's still possible for a special session on this before the end of the year, where they could take up the co-chair's proposal and the earmark issue all at once, and we could deal with this before the year is out.
We could spend the entire show on this. Robert Kirky, any final comments before we head to a break, just on the idea of a special session?
I mean, I think it's the idea of a special session before the end of the year is kind of crazy when we don't have a bill. We haven't seen any substantial analysis of who's impacted, who pays, who gains. We haven't, you know, the public hasn't really been heard in any meaningful fashion about the actual bill that's being proposed, and even legislators don't know what's in it. So I think to rush it through in just a few weeks remaining in the year, especially given you've got the holidays that people are going to be, you know, out of commission, I think it's rushed and it's unwise. Although I guess the governor said yesterday he thinks it's still, would like to have it in place. So.
Okay. That's Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Kirky, and we've been hearing from Tribune reporter Bethany Rogers. We're going to take a quick break in the show. Up next, an update on what's happening with homeless shelters in Salt Lake City. And we'll also turn to charges brought against some of the participants in a protest this summer over the Utah Inland Port. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, we'll immerse ourselves in the feminine side of a quintessential American musical style, jazz. But these female jazz vocalists are from all over.
Good night. Close your eyes and just sleep.
I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join me for Women of Jazz, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Join us Friday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Are you looking for a way to make your nonprofit organization more visible to our statewide community? Utah Public Radio's community calendar highlights events across the state, including music concerts, live theater, classes, workshops, art shows, lectures, festivals, volunteer opportunities, and much, much more. Just check out upr.org and head to our community calendar page. There you'll find our user-friendly submission link and the submission guidelines.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW. I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Taylor Stevens and Bethany Rogers and news columnist Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup, and you are invited to join us with your questions and comments. Again, the number is 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to @KCPW with your questions and comments. Well, last week on the show, we talked a little bit about the fact that the new Women's Resource Center here in Salt Lake City, soon after opening, this is the Homeless Women's Resource Center, it's already filled to capacity. And Taylor Stevens, this week, you reported that state and local leaders are considering a sort of stopgap measure to deal with the fact that this new system has created a shortfall in beds. The Road Home shelter, already overdue for closure, might not close just yet. What is going on with this story, Taylor?
Yeah, in a way, we're not any closer to a resolution on this issue. However, the state had previously said that keeping the Road Home open past the winter months, once the third and final resource center opens next month, was not kind of in the mix of options to deal with the overflow. However, at a meeting of Shelter the Homeless, which is the nonprofit that owns these three new homeless resource centers, on Tuesday, Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox said that's something that will be under consideration at an emergency meeting of state and local leaders who are working to address this issue.
And this would be keeping it open just through the winter, and then what would happen? It would close sometime next year. I mean, it was already slated to close in July of this year. That didn't happen.
Yeah, I think that's the thing a lot of advocates have been pointing out, right, is that through legislative mandate, the Road Home was originally scheduled, as you said, to close this summer. That's been pushed back several times for rainy weather in the spring, kind of some financial concerns Shelter the Homeless had for a while, and also because of construction delays in South Salt Lake. And so from the advocates' perspective, they say, you know, why not push this back one more time if there's a potential people might, you know, be cold on the streets, maybe die on the streets. That does happen in Salt Lake City. So, yeah, it's unclear exactly what would need to happen to keep the Road Home open, but it's been done before.
And it's on the table right now, at least through the winter. But then come spring, it will be warmer out, but that doesn't address the bed shortfall. What do officials say about that part of this? I mean, the fact that it is a stopgap.
Yeah, well, and just to back up a little bit, as you mentioned, the women's resource centers are full. All the beds are full, and they've been using emergency overflow center at St. Vincent de Paul. But we also got a better sense of what the problem may be for men next month when the third resource center opens. That resource center in South Salt Lake has 300 beds. Currently, there are 408 men at the Road Home. Some men have already moved into the co-ed shelter in Salt Lake. But that's, you know, the math, again, talking about math on this show, doesn't quite add up there. There's a 100 capacity difference that several members of the Shelter of the Homeless Board sort of asked, you know, what's the plan here? What are we going to do with this 100 extra men who are currently in the system right now who won't be able to fit? And so as Bethany and I have reported, the state was at one point looking at opening a shuttered liquor store possibly to house people who need emergency shelter. They've said that's not an option anymore, but I think it shows they're exploring all options, including keeping the road home open at this point.
I think we said that we talked about this last week, but when will the state or the county or city or whoever's involved in this, when will they be able to determine whether or not their new strategy on homelessness, meaning having these smaller homeless resource centers with fewer beds but that are meant to be sort of triage units to move people quickly out of homelessness, when will they be able to say whether or not that is a successful strategy?
Well, they have a plan, a strategy to address homelessness that they're going to come back and look at. And some of those factors include decreasing the length of stay for people in the system, getting more people into housing and having more people retain housing. One of the challenges with this new system, you know, it's supposed to be kind of this all services in one space, food, housing, help, laundry, you know, everything on site in one place, a way to help people enter housing more quickly. One of the problems that they're running into is that there's an affordable housing shortage and that the units just aren't there in a lot of cases to move people as quickly as they want. And so I think kind of in the next year, we'll see the success of this system. Right now, I do think it's fair to say this is a new system. A lot more people are seeking services, especially women. However, you know, this isn't a problem that wasn't anticipated with the capacity issues. We've written many stories at the Tribune over the years about the apparent gap of 400 capacity between the road home and these three new shelters, and we're seeing that play out now.
How are members, and this is circling back to the idea of potentially keeping the road home, homeless shelter in the Rio Grande neighborhood open near to Pioneer Park there, how are the, I guess, the businesses, especially the Pioneer Park Coalition, which was, I think, part advocating for the closure of the Road Home Shelter for quite a while. How are the neighbors of the Road Home Shelter responding to the concept of keeping it open through the winter? Either Taylor or Bethany Rogers.
Well, the Pioneer Park Coalition is not in favor of this. And they, you know, say this is a new system. We've got to let it work. We can see already that it is working because more people are seeking services. It's also kind of interesting to note the two mayoral candidates kind of have a rift on this issue. State Senator Luz Escamilla is not in favor of keeping the road home open. She points to a state audit that identified some problems within the shelter, including drug use, and says, you know, that was an old system, we need to move on, while Salt Lake City Councilwoman Erin Mendenhall says we shouldn't close the road home for political reasons. Nobody can, you know, be cold on the streets, and we need to keep it open. So there are different views on this, even among the people vying to lead the city.
Hmm. Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke addressing cold weather showing up, the fact that there isn't enough capacity, or there wouldn't be enough capacity if the road home weren't still there. Your thoughts on this story?
I mean, I think Taylor captured it perfectly. You've got 700 beds for 1,100 people, and it's freezing outside. Something's got to give, and you know, the keeping the road home open seems to be a logical solution since it's already a shelter. You know, you've got it set up already. You've got the security, you've got the beds, you've got everything there that you need, and it seems to make perfect sense. Now, of course, the landowners, the real estate owners who've been trying to get the road home closed for years are not going to be happy about that because it might hurt their property value and they might have, you know, homeless people around their neighborhood for a few more months. But at least they'll be alive. And so I think that's better than having them freezing outside their property. So I don't understand what the reluctance is. Obviously, the audit did find some problems at the road home. It's not an ideal situation for people to be in. Neither is homelessness. You know, the biggest thing that I think is an impediment here is, as Taylor mentioned again, that the affordable housing is just not there to move people out of these shelters into affordable housing. There was a program that is supposed to support affordable housing for 100 Utah residents that lapsed earlier this year and hasn't been renewed. The building that was anticipated has not come through. Some of the rehabilitation options are not available in the way that they wanted them to be because there's a lack of licensed therapists out there to accommodate the demand. And so something's got to give, and it seems like the easiest option at this point is just to keep the shelter open.
Taylor, well, there's a whole conversation about affordable housing that we could get into here, but just on the topic of whether or not the Road Home shelter stays open for the winter, when is this emergency meeting again? And is the public going to be allowed, or is there public comment at this meeting?
It's yet to be scheduled, and we don't really know the details as to whether there will be public comment. I can say that the Tribune will be fighting hard to be in that room.
Okay. Again, that's Salt Lake Tribune reporter Taylor Stevens. And thanks again for your coverage on this topic. Taylor, a reminder that you are tuned to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. This is our weekly news roundup, and we invite you to join us by calling 801-355-TALK, or you can tweet to us. We are at KCPW with your questions and comments. We'd love to hear them. Taylor, I actually want to turn to something else that you covered this week. This is the follow-up to coverage of an event that you and I were both present for back in July at the offices of the Salt Lake City Chamber. You reported this week that the Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office filed charges against 14 participants in that protest. Do you want to set the stage first? What actually happened at this protest back in July?
Whew, that's a big ask. Well, what we had is hundreds of protesters start out at kind of a civil kind of act of disobedience at the, well, more of a rally, I guess, at City Hall. And then it sort of turned into this civil disobedience, but then it turned again into kind of crossing over into the Chamber of Commerce building, occupying the lobby there. There were some people who went up to the sixth floor, tried to get into the chamber offices where former Inland Port board chair Derek Miller is the CEO at the Salt Lake Chamber. And it was very chaotic, to say the least. There were kind of altercations with police, people who felt that the police were overly aggressive, also situations where protesters were being overly aggressive. So you kind of saw it all, really, at this protest. And afterwards, it really, I think, rocked Salt Lake City politics for a while, one of the most violent protests we've seen in a long time. The governor called it borderline terrorism afterwards. And so it was very chaotic, but it's been a few months and we haven't really seen any fallout from it, although we did know that the police were reviewing footage, body cam footage, and other kind of recordings of that event. And on Monday, the district attorney's office filed charges against 10 people. And those carry kind of a Class B misdemeanor, also the possibility of third-degree felony for all 10. And then four other people were charged in justice court on misdemeanor counts.
What are the charges sort of, I mean, what do they look like? They're not charged with protesting, they're charged with what?
Rioting.
Rioting, okay. How have, I guess, protest groups responded to these charges? I know that, you know, in the aftermath of that protest back in July, there were complaints from those groups about the behavior of Salt Lake City police at this protest.
Yeah, Civil Riot, which was one of the groups that organized this protest, along with ICE Free SLC, Utah Against Police Brutality, other community groups, said that the charges were inflated with the goal of silencing communities concerned about the wealthy class of politicians trying to profit off of the destruction of land and the poisoning of our air. That last part is a quote. Also, Utah Against Police Brutality, one of the leaders there, Dave Newland, who also is a former Salt Lake Tribune employee, just for full disclosure, he was very concerned that an internal audit into police conduct at that event was not going to be released to the public.
So this is an internal audit by the Salt Lake City Police Department of how officers, I guess, behaved at this protest. That won't be public information. They'll just review it internally.
Yeah, and I called for an update on this Monday and was told that it's not protocol to release those to the public unless there is some kind of employment change as a result of the audit, and they said they don't anticipate that now, and so they won't be releasing it.
Police, meanwhile, point to video footage showing, you know, one protester spitting on an officer, another officer being dragged into a crowd and punched and kicked. I don't know. These charges, maybe I'll bring in the columnist here, Salt Lake Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke. There's two different sort of perspectives on what's happening here.
Yeah, I mean, there is, and this was, optically, it was bad, and I think it wasn't helpful to the opponents of the Inland Port. And I think the charges are to be expected. You know, if you engage in a protest like this, you get arrested, you're going to be charged. It sort of comes with the territory. You know, we saw it during the civil rights movement, right? People got arrested for a reason. So I don't know that it's necessarily surprising. I am a little concerned about the, as Taylor mentioned, that the review of the police's, the behavior of the police officers is not going to be made public, because they're public employees and should be publicly accountable as well. So, and there were there were video of the event that was disconcerting, I think, some of the officers' conduct during that, and some of the conduct toward the officers as well. So there needs to be some public accountability, I think, on both sides of the equation.
Taylor, this is just sort of a weird detail from the story, but since the time of the protest, there has been talk of there being feces or urine in the offices of the Salt Lake City Chamber in the aftermath of that protest. Can you talk about what happened there, what the chamber says, what protesters say, and so on?
Yeah, before we do, I just want to really quickly mention that Salt Lake City Police said that they had documented 6 assaults against officers. And so, you know, there was, like Robert said, sort of on both sides, documented problems. As far as the feces and urine, I was on the 6th floor for a time. Officers told everyone on the floor, that even media, that they would be arrested if they didn't leave. And so I made the choice to keep reporting the story rather than get arrested. But so I didn't see any of this. And, you know, protesters, I think, have denied this kind of property damage in the past. What we're hearing from the police and the probable cause statements is that the organization that was tasked with kind of cleaning this up charged $7,000, found fresh feces and urine. So, that's, we're kind of hearing two different stories again, which I think really exemplifies this protest, that there's a view of the protesters of one way things happened and a view of kind of the establishment or the police of a different way things went down.
Okay. Again, that's Salt Lake Tribune reporter Taylor Stevens. I'm sorry that we have to cut this conversation short, just in the interest of time and for a conversation that I had with a reporter in San Juan County, Zach Podmore, about electioneering. We're going to take a quick break on the show. When we come back, we will turn to our underplayed stories of the week. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is brought to you by our members and the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, celebrating the recent protection of more than 660,000 acres of wilderness in the San Rafael Swell and Labyrinth and Desolation Canyons. Information about programs and membership is available at suwa.org.
Utah Public Radio is broadcasting engaging and impactful stories of Utah 24 hours, 7 days a week on the air. But we have a lot more to say, and so much more for you to hear. The UPR social media team is bringing you Utah's most important stories right to your feed. Stay up to date and join the discussion by connecting with us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. Don't forget to use the hashtag IAMUPR. Why wait? Pick up your mobile device now and get the most out of Utah Public Radio. And just as always, stay tuned for more on the air from UPR.
Utah Public Radio would like to thank our partners Beezer Lock and Key for sponsoring programming on Utah Public Radio. Find out how you can become a sponsor by emailing debbie.andrew@usu.edu.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Taylor Stevens and Bethany Rogers, and by news columnist Robert Gerke. It's our Friday morning news roundup. And again, to save time for a conversation about San Juan County special election, we're going to turn right now to our underplayed stories of the week. And Bethany Rogers, we haven't heard from you in a little while. How about we start with you for a pick for underplayed story?
Okay, so I picked one by my colleague Thomas Burr about Pierre Delecto, which is Senator Mitt Romney's alter ego for his lurker Twitter account. He was unmasked. Pierre Delecto was unmasked by Slate. But Thomas kind of gave a good rundown of some of the details, who Pierre Delecto follows, and a couple of the other important details of the story.
I just want to know where the name came from, but it's a great name. Okay, that's a pick from Bethany Rogers. Robert Gerke, let's go with you for your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Mine's a business story, actually, which didn't get much attention. Zions Bank is laying off about 5% of its workforce, which equates to about 500 people. And they're doing this, they say, to increase efficiency and maintain profitability. Probably worth noting that they, in the third quarter, earned $220 million for the $823 million in revenue. So $220 million in profit, $823 million in revenue, and are laying off 500 people. A lot of them are going to be like the bank branch employees and things like that.
Okay. That's Robert Gerke with his pick for underplayed story of the week. And Taylor Stevens, your choice.
Yeah, I want to highlight a story from my colleague Kathy Stevenson. As Utah changes to a higher percent by volume alcohol at the beginning of the month, the liquor store is looking at having to drain the lesser volume alcohol down the drain, the beer, on October 31st, unless people can get there first to get the discount.
And this is because it's going from 4% to 5%, and the state liquor store can't hold the beer that will be sold privately. Definitely an interesting read. Check it out at sltrib.com. For my part, I'm going to, yesterday there's a story. Governor Gary Herbert held his monthly televised news conference on KUED, and he talked about tax reform and about conversion therapy and other important news topics. After the meeting ended, though, Herbert said something divisive and controversial. According to Tribune reporter Ben Wood's Twitter feed, Herbert, after the cameras were off, said that when he eats peanuts, he eats them shell and all, meaning with the husk on. And some people were disgusted by that, apparently. I will say this, that if everyone were like Governor Herbert, the old Bar X floor would have been a lot cleaner. That's a joke for a very specific group of people.
I got it.
Okay, I'm glad to hear it. Anyway, you can check out that, or you can weigh in on that great peanut controversy on Ben Wood's Twitter feed, and you can check out all of the stories we've been talking about today at sltrib.com. Taylor Stevens, Bethany Rogers, and Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining me on the show today.
Thanks Roger.
We're going to wrap things up today for the final 10 minutes of the show with a conversation that I had yesterday with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Zach Podmore. He's a Tribune reporter in San Juan County, and we had a conversation about a special election that is happening in that county. Take a listen. So, Zach Podmore, there is a special election happening in San Juan County on November 5th, and the only thing on the ballot is Proposition 10. What would that proposition do?
The proposition would create a study committee made up of residents of the county who would have a year to hold a number of public meetings and then eventually make recommendations on whether or not the form of county government should be changed. Right now, San Juan County, like most counties in Utah, has a three-member county commission, but there are a number of larger county governments that are allowed under Utah state code. So the commission, the study committee could potentially recommend a 5 or 7-member commission or some other form of county government.
Who's behind the push to change the form of government in San Juan County, or why is that push happening now? And I know that there's a little bit of a backstory there that you're probably going to have to go into.
Yeah, that's something that is a bit controversial between proponents of the proposition and opponents of it. In 2012, the Navajo Nation sued San Juan County over Voting Rights Act violations, and that lawsuit lasted quite a while. It was just finally resolved this year, But in 2017, a federal court determined that the county had racially gerrymandered its voting districts. The county is just slight majority Native American, but Native Americans had never controlled the county commission or the school board. So the federal court brought in a special master to redraw the voting districts. And in 2018, last November, two Navajo commissioners were elected, making the first majority Native American commission that the county has had before. And just a few months after that new commission came in, a ballot initiative was started, led by Blanding Mayor Joe Lyman, to initiate this proposition that's going to be on the ballot in November. There is some debate about whether the petition drive was started in response to the majority Native American commission. Joe Lyman, the main sponsor, says it was not. He says he supported a larger county commission for decades and just happened to start this petition drive at the same time as the new commissioners were coming in. So yeah, it's kind of a complicated backstory, but
right. How do the, as you said, this is the first time that there's been a majority Navajo, and also at the same time, we should say majority Democrat, or the commission now is majority Navajo and majority Democrat. How has the commission been responding to the push, to change the form of government, this seemingly new push to change the form of government coming on the heels of that court-mandated redistricting, Zach?
Yeah, the Democratic commissioners, Kenneth Maryboy and Willie Gray Eyes, have both made public statements suggesting that they think the push to change the form of county government is an attempt to unseat them and kind of undermine the newfound Democratic power in the county. And yeah, that's, like I said, is disputed by the people who are pushing the petition and the proposition, but it's definitely a subject to debate here.
In San Juan County, so there's this special election that would launch a study that could result in another ballot initiative to change the form of government, adding more commission seats, essentially. But just this week, you wrote about some irregularities in the early voting process for this special election. This is something that the ACLU of Utah is drawing attention to. What are these irregularities?
Yeah, so separate from the gerrymandering case, there was a separate voting rights case in San Juan County from 2016 to 2018 that the county and the ACLU settled on last year that is mostly around Navajo language accessibility in elections. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of requirements under that settlement, including the county has to air Navajo language ads on local radio stations announcing election details. It has to hold early voting locations on the Navajo Nation, near the Navajo Nation in the county. And the county has missed several of the deadlines required under that settlement agreement. They've just missed them by a number of days in a couple of cases. But the ACLU was drawing attention to that, and they said the county has been responsive and trying to work with the ACLU to resolve those issues. And then last week, it was discovered that there was an op-ed by Joe Lyman, the Blanding mayor, that was being distributed at early voting locations on the Navajo Nation. And the ACLU was concerned this could amount to electioneering, which is, trying to push voters one way or the other in a polling place. And then the county clerk, John David Nielsen, admitted that he was the one that was giving out those op-eds in an attempt to, he said, to educate voters about the history of the ballot initiative, which is a little bit confusing and controversial. So it's not really known yet what will come out of that acknowledgement that he's been involved, but it could amount to electioneering.
The op-ed in question, it's in favor of this proposition, correct?
That's correct. It's written by the main proponent of the proposition, right, Joe Lyman, but it's the op-ed that was being handed out, the letter to the editor, I guess, more specifically, was trying to respond to Navajo Commission. So it wasn't necessarily pushing voters to support the proposition, but it was giving background on how it came to be by somebody who certainly supports it.
When you say that it was being distributed or handed out at polling locations, you know, on the Navajo Nation or wherever that may have been in San Juan County, what did that look like? I mean, somebody waiting for voters to show up, or was it just posted? How was it being distributed?
My understanding is the county had a table with election materials on it, including the schedule for upcoming early voting locations on the Navajo Nation. And beside that, those official county materials, there were photocopies of the letter to the editor that were highlighted in color highlighter around the relevant article, and that voters were allowed to take, you know, copies of that article with them as they left. And the county clerk was, you know, not only aware that they were there, but had put them there in order to try and, he said, educate voters about what was going on.
What are the ramifications of electioneering if it's found to have happened for, you know, the county clerk or anybody else who was involved in, you know, distributing this op-ed at polling locations?
Yeah, electioneering, if it is found to be that, is a Class A misdemeanor under Utah code, which can carry a year in prison and a $2,500 fine. I'm not sure if there's any differences between just a citizen engaged in electioneering versus a county official, but those are the penalties that go with that.
Zach, just in the interest of time, we're low on time here, and so I'll just ask you, we've got just over 2 weeks until the election itself. Any big pieces of the story that you're expecting to see resolved before then?
Not really that I know of at this point. It's not clear if the ACLU is going to take any action against the county. They said they're working with the county right now, and the county has been helpful and responsive to their requests. And so it'll just be interesting to watch to see if there is any big push from either the San Juan County Democratic Party or some groups that have been involved with the lawsuits to try and respond to these allegations in any kind of direct manner in the next few weeks before the election.
Zach Podmore is a Report for America Corps member covering conflict and change in San Juan County for the Salt Lake Tribune. Zach Podmore, thanks very much for filling us in today on this.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And that conversation about the special election in San Juan County and allegations of electioneering happening there wraps up this edition of Behind the Headlines, a co-production of the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. You can find podcasts of this show and all of KCPW's local programs at kcpw.org or through your podcast app. And you can always catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter. Just search KCPW. A reminder that we are an independent, nonpartisan source of news and ideas, and we always welcome your feedback, your suggestions for coverage, your help as volunteers, and of course, your contributions. You can do your part and learn more at kcpw.org. Thanks to Operations Director Jesse Ellis for his work on the show, and to the Utah Public Radio team in Logan. Until next time, I'm Roger McDonough. Have a great weekend.
This is John Meyer with the Utah Climate Center. Utah Public Radio and the Associated Press Health and Science Desk are partnering to bring you online-only stories of efforts to save and revive ecosystems around the world. The series, What Can Be Saved, includes weekly stories about reversing some of humankind's most destructive past actions and preserving Earth's vital natural habitats. What Can Be Saved, from UPR and AP, now through December 3rd at upr.org.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, and also heard at upr.org.